My name is J. Lauren Sangster, and welcome to my podcast, Flying Over the Hedge. The name of the podcast is a reference to my newly released book, titled The Girl Who Flew Over the Honeysuckle Hedge, Her Lifelong Journey of Coping and Healing with CPTSD, or Complex Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. I am that girl. In my book, I discuss various traumas, beginning at an early age. I also discuss various coping and healing methods I have used as I navigate life, to include humor and music. Today I'm going to discuss something that I wrote about in my book that I'm still pretty sensitive about. I had a very specific flashback that left me in a state of what I call sofa surfing, meaning I was on my sofa and for some 30 hours before I was able to function okay again. The flashback was triggered in a very innocent way. I wanted to watch a video of a fox stealing, I think, Tinkerbell figurine from someone's back garden. I opened the article based on the headline in some online newspaper, and when I read the location of the event with the fox in Swansea, Wales, my mind flashed back to a very real moment that I had not recalled since I suppose I was there some 25 plus years ago. I always knew I'd traveled to Swansea, Wales, and I always vividly remember the exact area in the flashback. But I had not remembered very specific details until I had the flashback. Nor had I experienced the emotional upheaval that took place in my system. I experienced physical and emotional sensations as I began to say over and over, almost like a mantra, "What did he give me? What did he do to me?" I felt sick at my stomach and I experienced extreme fear. Even as I watched the man who would later hold me captive and torture me throw his head back and laugh with great pleasure. In my book, I discussed being held captive and tortured. I shared some about this on my last episode when I discussed gut instinct. It was while I was writing my book that I experienced this flashback moment. Joining me later will be my ex-partner and my longtime friend, the man I call Laszlo in my book. I was in contact with Laszlo during my ordeal in France. So, what is a flashback? Why did I experience it after so many years, and did the man I called Giles drug me? I will probably never know. I'm not sure I want to, especially because of something he told me he was telling everyone he introduced me to, and I wrote about that in my book. I won't discuss it here. So what is a flashback? It's a vivid mental experience where someone relives a past event, often a traumatic one, as if it's happening in the present moment. It's commonly associated with post-traumatic stress disorder, where the person may experience intense emotions and sensations related to the traumatic event. So here are some key points, and I'm telling you these because I think it's important to be educated about flashbacks, especially if you are having them. They suddenly appear, often without warning, and they feel very real. They can involve not just visual images, but also sounds, smells, taste, and physical sensations associated with the traumatic event. So certain situations, environments, or stimuli can trigger a flashback. They can be very distressing and disrupt a person's daily functioning because they can cause intense emotions such as fear, anxiety, or anger. As I said before, this particular flashback stopped me pretty much in my tracks for some 30 hours. My heart raced, I experienced panic, I was extremely nauseous, and I had difficulty breathing. I slept very little, and in my wakeful hours, I cried pretty much nonstop, especially because what I believe this meant, that I'd been drugged. As a note, flashbacks can vary in intensity and duration. They don't always affect someone for this long. If you join me for my first podcast, where I discuss trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder, You'll understand that PTSD is a mental health condition that can develop after a person has experienced or witnessed a traumatic event, such as war, a natural disaster, sexual assault, or other violence. One common symptom of both PTSD and complex PTSD, which I was diagnosed with, are flashbacks that can be triggered by these certain stimuli. So for me, the certain stimuli for this flashback was reading the words Swansea Wales. So why do flashbacks occur? I didn't really understand this until I read some about it, and I find it very interesting, and I love that I have this education now. Post-traumatic stress disorder is essentially a memory filing error caused by a traumatic event. Meaning, when you experience something really traumatic, your body suspends normal operations and it temporarily shuts down some bodily functions such as memory processing. So during trauma, your brain is thinking, processing and understand what's happening right now is not important. Getting your legs ready to run, your heart rate up, and your arms ready to fight this danger is what's important right now. Meaning your brain is saying, I'll get back to processing later. Okay, so until the danger passes, the mind doesn't produce a memory for this traumatic event in the normal way. Then, when the brain does go back to trying to process the trauma, your mind presents the situation as a memory for filing, but because it doesn't exist in your memory yet, it sees the trauma event as a situation in the current timeline. And this can be very distressing. So the distress is due to the fact that the brain is unable to recognize this as a memory because it never got to process one during the trauma. So if something reminds you of the trauma, meaning a trigger like the facts of what happened, the emotions associated with the trauma, and the sensations, touch, taste, sound, vision, movement, and smell, then these triggers can be presented by the mind in the form of a flashback, again, as if they are happening right now. Okay, why does the brain do this? We know our senses are attached to our memories. We know, for instance, the smell of something can bring back memories. Here's a fun example. For me, the smell of frying chicken brings back the visual memory of my grandmother standing in front of the stove in a simple house dress, but wearing a very long strand of fake pearls. My grandmother was just that kind of person, and I love that image. Also, I talk about certain songs and the positive or negative attachments I have with them. This is sound causing me to think of a memory. So these flashback moments remind us where we were and what we were doing when something momentous happened. For instance, I know exactly where I was and what I was doing when I heard about the events of 9/11. And like I discussed, a flashback event isn't always negative, like the memory of my grandmother and her fake pearls. Or here's another one. When I'm near a particular pier in Maine, I know how I felt and what a beautiful day it was the first time I met my partner, John, in person. I can see a vivid image of him walking towards me. However, for the purpose of this discussion, I'm talking about negative flashbacks, not positive ones. So we know that a memory is an all-encompassing event, and the triggers can be external and/or internal. I was triggered by reading the name of a location. That's an external trigger. But also, I'd been writing my life story, and I had written about the events that took place while I was out of the country. I explain in my book why I was triggered by reading Swansea Wales, so I won't go into that here. So externally, Swansea Wales. Internally, I'd brought up certain traumatic events to write about them. And it was tough. But in a later episode, I discussed the remarkable help I had while writing. And I will have that person who helped me through some very difficult writing moments on my podcast to explain how I was healing, even as I was bringing up difficult past events while I was writing. We often know what triggers us, but sometimes we don't. So I'm going to explain a few things to note about triggers and ways I began to identify my triggers. First, it's possible for the same trigger to affect someone differently at different times. For example, I stopped listening to Blondie's song, One Way or Another. I love the song. I love the beat of it. But she wrote it because of someone stalking her, and the lyrics hit too close to home for me because I had been stalked. I couldn't listen to the song for years. Now, of course, I recall why I didn't listen to the song, but if I hear it today, I wouldn't be triggered the same way I was then. Why? I've done a lot of healing. Here's another example, and I've added this one in as of this morning. When I initially experienced my flashback, it took that 30 hours to function again. When I wrote about it in my book, I felt triggered and nauseous. Of course I did. I cried a lot, but it didn't take me 30 hours to get through it. When I wrote these notes for this particular podcast, I cried a little. I experienced nausea again, but not for long. Today, I woke up feeling nauseous, and that has not let up. So the triggers have lessened, but I guess I'm always going to feel nauseous when I think about this flashback because, well, my book is out now, so my full life story is out, and now I'm talking about this flashback on a podcast, and this is something I truly never thought I would or could do. So I know my system is telling me this is still an uncomfortable subject for me. Oh, God, of course it is. I'm talking about a flashback with the content and the words that I uttered that terrified me. And yet here I am. I'm talking about it to complete strangers. I'm healing. I'm not crying. I'm not emotional. I'm healing. So I'm experiencing the flashback in a different way. Same person, different experience of it. And I realize I haven't had that flashback again, and I know some people may have a flashback over and over. Still, I am healing from this. So how one feels physically and psychologically when a flashback happens makes a difference. It's important to continue to try to heal. So one thing we might do to help us heal is to keep a journal. I wrote down dreams for many years, and later I read those dreams together and was able to realize that my mind had one common theme in them, even though they covered a long period of time and they were vastly different. I won't go into the particulars of the dreams here, but journaling does help. Another thing we can do is, of course, talk to a therapist. There are so many treatments for PTSD and CPTSD that often include therapy to help us process and make sense of the trauma event. And a therapist can help us learn to manage flashbacks. There's cognitive behavioral therapy, which can help us identify and change negative thought patterns. There's also exposure therapy, where we are gradually exposed to the memories and situations that trigger our flashbacks. EMDR therapy, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing therapy, helps to, of course, reprocess the flashback memories. And I'll talk about this a little more in my next podcast, where I will be discussing various healing methods I've used over the years. There's also medications such as antidepressants, which may be prescribed to help manage the symptoms of PTSD. Now, I have to say I didn't do well with these, both not long after my experience in France and again when I tried them a few years ago. I didn't handle the side effects well, so I get it if some people truly can't handle the side effects. However, I do believe they can be very beneficial to many. In addition to going to therapy, and this is something I discovered by accident, acupuncture can help one's recovering with the effects of PTSD and CPTSD. Again, I'll talk about this in my next podcast, and that one's pretty exciting. There are ways to manage flashback moments outside of treatment. Deep breathing exercises help. I recently felt afraid in the woods. I didn't have a visual flashback. I had an emotional one and a physical one. I felt anxious and I experienced being afraid as I had been in France, but the fear was, of course, nowhere near as intense. It didn't seem to matter that I could logically understand that I was safe and I was with my partner. He reminded me to breathe deeply. I was fine in a few minutes because I followed this deep breathing exercise. So this is one grounding technique that can help bring us back to the present. But there are others. Focusing on our surroundings. I tried that during this recent event. It didn't work as well as I hoped, but I did mentally note that I was trying to see the logic of my safety, even as I was experiencing anxiety. Okay, so I went to another grounding technique, deep breathing. So using our senses to describe what we see, hear, smell, taste, and feel can help us return to the present. Also, I've done this before, and I still do it on occasion. Say a calming mantra to ourselves, something like, I am calm, I am safe, I am calm, I am safe. The words calm and safe begin to resonate with you mentally. I know this next way to self-care may feel awkward. Reach out for support. Family, friends, or a mental health professional can help. More importantly, they want to help. So it's important to learn how to self-care. And by this, I'm talking about what is called our window of tolerance. PTSDUK.org describes window of tolerance as the zone we can be in when our emotions are balanced and controlled, meaning we think clearly and we react rationally. So we're able to feel and think at the same time, and we feel present in the moment. We're open and curious, not defensive. We have awareness and can have boundaries for ourselves and others. Our reactions are flexible to fit certain situations. And I think most importantly, we feel safe. So we're in our window of tolerance when we're able to diffuse perceived threats to our emotional balance. I had a therapist that called this something like my emotional thermometer, and my goal was to stay within a healthy temperature range on the emotional thermometer. I write in my book how difficult it was for me during that particular time with this therapist to find my window of tolerance or stay within my emotional thermometer, and I write why I believe this happened. I tell you this because I know it isn't always easy, and it takes practice. Another thing that takes practice is self-compassion when we don't meet our intention to stay within our window of tolerance. We must be patient with ourselves, and we must continue to try. Here with me today is Laszlo, my ex-partner and longtime friend. I talked a little bit about Laszlo in my last podcast. Hello, Laszlo, and thank you for joining me today.
Well, it's a pleasure. Let me just say something first. I just think that it is incredibly brave of you to basically relive this whole part of your life. And I think it's going to help a lot of people. Anyway, I'm very proud of you, and I think you're doing a great thing.
Thank you so much for that. That means a lot. And it's interesting because I had not put this in, and then I thought, okay, why am I having Laszlo on? You know, why am I having Laszlo go through this? Because I know this was difficult for you as well. And I think I know a part of me wanted some kind of validation, someone to say, I know Lauren, I knew her parents, I knew her family in the events she writes about, even though you weren't there for my childhood, that of course you know that those events happened. And more importantly, you were a part of my life when the events in France happened, and you have been ever since. So I think partly due to the experience we shared of what happened to me in France, we have remained friends for so long. So did you have any residual effects from what was happening to me in France or after I got back to New York City and my captor came to New York and stalked me? Meaning, did you have any vicarious or secondary trauma? I don't know if we would call it trauma for you, but I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
Well, I don't know. I certainly didn't have any flashbacks. But it was very difficult for me, certainly not to the extent that it was difficult for you, but it was very difficult for me because I felt very helpless. I felt that this, what was happening to you, was really beyond my, you know, my realm of experience. And I, you know, I'd seen stories like this in movies and read about them, but I really didn't know the best way to handle them. And I felt very, I felt guilty in the sense that, you know, I wasn't able to protect you. And you were really, you know, especially, I think especially when you were over there, you know, we did speak on the phone several times, which I don't know, you didn't remember so much when you came back, but we spoke several times on the phone. And one time you were in, when I spoke to you, you were in a phone booth, I believe, and I'm not sure where you were, what city, you were in a town in the phone booth, and you had managed to slip away for a while from your, from Giles. And it was so frustrating because I was trying to get you to, you know, just, you know, you're free now, go to a U.S. consulate, go to the police, go talk to someone about your situation, because I sensed you were really all alone and you had no, you felt hopeless. You felt like there was no avenue of escape, and you were in a very, you know, just a terrible situation. And you were, it was difficult because you were, I think you felt so helpless, and you felt also that, I don't know if it was Stockholm syndrome or what, but you felt very much like by yourself, you were sort of helpless, which was not the Lauren I knew. I mean, you were an outspoken.
Yeah, I'm kind of a spitfire. Yeah, I speak my mind. I say, how dare you treat me that way? And
yeah,
and I understand there was a very different mentality and emotional state when I was speaking to you.
Yes, you came up from a very, you know, different background in the South, and you moved to New York and you really made your way. And I know that times it was difficult for you and so on, but you really were, you were very brave, and you know, New York's a tough place, and you were, I think, doing very well. And it was just really kind of troubling to me that when I spoke to you on the phone those times, that you seemed very tentative and kind of, you know, helpless. And it just, I just couldn't, I couldn't connect the two people, if you know what I mean. So you seemed like a different person.
Yeah. I do write about the system. It was a very systematic brainwashing that was happening to me by Giles. And I write about where my mind got to and where my mind had to go. I won't discuss that here. But what I had to do in order to survive was most definitely a way that I never, ever, ever thought I could be. And so I had to do certain things, and I most definitely was not myself. And I did feel helpless and very alone and absolutely terrified. I was traumatized. I was in a state of trauma. And I find it shocking that when I was writing, and so I would send my notes to two people. I had two alpha readers while I was writing my book, because it was very, very hard for me to write it, and I needed to know how people would take it. So you were one of my alpha readers, and my sister-in-law, Anne, was another alpha reader. And God bless you both, because I know it was some tough reading. But I was really absolutely gobsmacked when you very gently, you know, we would speak on the phone, and you said, you know, I got to tell you, where you were over in France a lot longer than what you're talking about here in the book. And I just couldn't get my mind even then wrapped around it, because I had spent so many years just pressing it down and putting it away from me. And, you know, was happily married to Mike, and, I just, it was almost like while we were married, I had suppressed so much of it that it was almost like this bad dream I had. And it was that far. And then even when I was writing, and I wrote with purpose, I would eat the same foods, use smells, drink the same drinks. I'd get out visuals for each days of writing. And I had everything that I could, and I still did not recall until you said, oh, yeah. And I think maybe it's because I trust you. I know you so well, and you're not going to say anything to me that, you know, is going to mislead me. But you had to remind me. I was there for nearly 4 months when I talked about 6 weeks. And that was really hard for me. And one thing you also reminded me of that, and this is hard for me because I still don't recall this, is that you were talking to my mother on a very regular basis, trying to figure out how to get me home. I don't know if you want to say anything about that, but it was, I still cry when I think about the worry that I put both of you through, especially because Giles kept telling me that when he was finished with me, no one would care what happened to me or where I was. And so, yeah, I don't know if you want to say anything about that.
Well, I did after, I don't know how long, my memories are somewhat fuzzy about the whole period, but I did call your mother at a certain point and I said, have you heard from Lauren? And she said, no. And I said, well, you know, I don't know if she knew that you were in France. You may have told her that you were going over to study stamp collecting or something like that, but
Yes, I did. Yeah. And I actually was allowed, to call her one time under, I was in a state of duress and I discussed the whole conversation in my book and what happened during that conversation that caused me to not be able to tell her what was happening to me. My life was being threatened while I was on the phone, so I couldn't say anything.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she knew I was there, but she didn't know anything about what was happening, especially during that phone call. I could not tell her.
Well, she was very concerned. Your mother was a wonderful person. I should broadcast to the world. She was a really wonderful person who went through a lot with your inner family life. And she really had a big heart. And she was very sensible, and it really did me good to talk to her, and I think, I hope it did her good, but I sort of was pretty blunt with her. I said, you know, I'm very worried about her. I think she's being held hostage, or she really is in trouble, and she was, yeah, she was very worried. So we used to talk, I don't know how many times we talked, maybe 5 or 6 times, but we talked to, or maybe even more, but we kind of comforted each other and kept trying to come up with ideas to get you home, but nothing seemed possible. So anyway, but she loved you a lot, and she was a really, really great person for me to talk to. It helped me to talk to her. So,
And I just love that you said that, because here's a point I want to make. And I've been talking about this in a kind of a roundabout way in my book, but it has to do with generational trauma. Both of my parents experienced trauma, and they passed trauma on to their children. Me, I was their youngest. So you experienced my parents and my family, as I don't know, I guess you, they were always kind to you. I know that you knew there were some problems, but you experienced both of my parents as kind and considerate human beings. So this is a perfect example of how two things can be true of a person, or in this case, one or more family members. One, they may experience and pass down generational trauma, thereby causing emotional injury to their children, which is what happened with my siblings and me. And two, they can be funny, sweet, sensitive people capable of expressing kindnesses. Because, and this is something I will talk about more at length in my last episode, we are never just the trauma event that happened. We are never the victim, just the victim. We are never just the person causing harm. The parts make up the whole. So we are also mothers, fathers, and siblings, children. We're writers, singers, surgeons, golfers, wildlife biologists. And we are fragile, and we are strong, and we are resilient. So I love that you are here, you knew my parents, and you're saying you experienced them as, they could be funny, they could be loving, and they were very kind, but they also passed on trauma to their children. And so we can, yes. It's not just they're these horrible trauma figures that was just a part of our daily life, a part of, who they were and how things were. We also had some great moments, and I write about some very charming moments in my book.
You had told me quite a bit about your family before I first came down with you to visit them. And I have to say that I was a little apprehensive before I met them, yeah. And when we pulled up to your house and so on, but they could not have been nicer to me. I think your father, who I know was a complicated guy, but he and I kind of bonded because he liked watching sports on TV and so on, and I did too. And I think he just enjoyed the fact that there was a male around.
Because they had three girls.
It was all girls. So we got along okay, and I'm very glad that I got to know them. But I do understand that really they made your life, intentionally or not, they made your life quite difficult and your sister's lives. So it was. But it was an interesting experience for me, that's for sure.
I want to talk next about my call with you when I needed support and I wasn't in therapy at the time. I called you and I told you about my flashback, the one I've discussed today. I mean, it rocked me pretty hard. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, what do you have to say about that? It was actually you that said, do you think you could have been drugged?
Right.
Because of what I kept saying, what did he give me? What did he do to me?
All along, I had thought that you possibly were being drugged there. I mean, I didn't really bring it up, but I don't know why. But then when you told me that flashback, that's what popped into my head. It just seemed very kind of surreal and strange.
Yeah, and something I didn't know is that, drugging people, this was in the mid-90s, it had become a thing. And to me, I was just so ignorant of it. And I write about how often I was told, drink this wine. I was kind of forced to drink it. And I write about how that all came about with Giles. And when I look back on it, I think, oh my gosh, this was happening. And I was so clueless that it was happening.
That really was the sort of, as far as I remember, that was kind of the peak or the beginning of awareness of these date rape drugs and all that stuff. And
and it was pretty big in France at that time. I've read about it.
Yeah,
it was pretty big.
Yeah.
And
some terrible
abuse
cases.
Was very big there. Thank you for joining me. I'm Laszlo, I really do appreciate your time. And it is interesting as I think, thank you for, I guess, the validation of some of my memories and some of the things I've discussed. And I think it's been important to me, if I'm honest, and I've been thinking about this, we both know that you are one of the last people alive in my life that was around then. Even my therapist has passed away. And so that was, you know, I was, her name is Molly, and you knew Molly. And she was my therapist for 17 years. And both my parents are gone. My surrogate parents are gone. And you are the pretty much the last remaining person that knows anything about this or has known anything about this until, of course, now with my book coming out. So I do thank you for being here. And I appreciate you talking to me about it. And I don't know, giving my parents a soft side with your conversation. I really do appreciate that.
Well, I am honored to have been included, and best of luck with the book. And I know it's going to help people. And I just think you've done a great job.
Thank you so much. So what I'm going to talk about next is still equally emotionally raw for me, not just the flashback. See, I thought I would always have this buffer of thinking that I would just know if someone had touched me. Even if I couldn't remember the event, I would just know. But last year, it's still upsetting to me. Last year, when I read the very first news article about the case in France, the one with Gisèle Pelicot, I began to immediately sob. I was nearly inconsolable because Gisèle Pelicot's story took away the buffer of me thinking I would just know, because she was drugged by her own husband and she endured rapes for a decade by some 80 men without her permission. And she did not know. She knew she had a memory loss. I had a memory loss. I lost a lot of memory there. And she worried about having dementia. But she never, ever suspected her husband was drugging her and allowing men to rape her. I've had to talk a lot about this revelation in therapy, that one can experience being drugged and raped without knowing it, and that it can happen repeatedly. I've tried to come to terms with the flashback I had and with what the man I call Giles in my book told me he kept telling people about me. Of course, he was saying it in French, and I didn't understand the language, so I didn't know what he was saying or whether what he told me he was saying was true or not. And although I'm a person that likes to get at the truth, I believe I don't ever want to know what happened to me. I'd be remiss if I didn't provide a few statistics about drug use for sexual assaults and how the drugs may affect someone's memory. The Drug Enforcement Administration provides information about drugs and sexual assault on their website, dea.gov, dea.gov. They state, and I'm paraphrasing, that drugs are used to compromise an individual's ability to consent to sexual activity because they inhibit a person's ability to resist and they can prevent them from remembering the assault. Sexual assault where a drug is used can happen to anyone, by anyone, meaning drugs are used to assault someone regardless of gender or sexual orientation. The person committing the violence can be a date, a stranger, an acquaintance, or someone you have known a long time. So the DEA notes that although the term date rape is often used, that it's misleading. And this is important. It's because the circumstances in which these drugs are used often do not involve a dating situation. The DEA also notes that alcohol remains the most commonly used drugs in crimes of sexual assault. For a list of other drugs being used to commit these crimes, please go to their website, dea.gov. But please remember that in certain amounts, any drug can leave you helpless. During a Google search, I found a few ways you might tell if your drink has been spiked. It may taste salty or bitter where it didn't before. It might look cloudy or foggy where it was clear before, or it might have excessive bubbles. Florida State University's Department of Student Support and Transitions mentions a few symptoms you may experience if you have been drugged. For the sake of time, because this has been a lot to discuss in my allotted time frame for doing the podcast, please go to their website at dsst.fsu.edu. And of course, if you experience any of the side effects they mention, please seek help immediately. As a reminder, you may find any website I mentioned during a podcast on my website, flyingoverthehedge.com, where I have a specific page dedicated to these websites to make it easier for my listeners. Also, I list the number of websites in the back of my book and on my website for anyone who believes you have been assaulted. And these include websites that can help you financially, because seeking help shouldn't break your bank account. I want to mention there are a few devices on the market that may help you detect if your drink has been spiked. I didn't know about this, but I Googled it, and this is what I found. Amazon.com sells Drink Check. That's DrinkCheck. It's a drink spike test that says it is clinically validated to detect common date rape drugs such as ketamine, cocaine, and scopolamine, which is a drug used for nausea, vomiting, and motion sickness. Another new one on me. You apply two drops of your drink onto the test strip, and you get results in under 15 seconds. I have to note that these strips and anything else out of the market that help you test for drugs will not pick up all drugs that may be used to spike a drink. And the morally dysfunctional people who choose to use the drugs to commit these horrific crimes keep changing the drugs. So please, please pay attention to your drink. Don't let it out of your sight. And if you do suspect your drink has been drugged, for heaven's sake, don't drink it. Don't drink it. My hope is that this discussion has helped anyone who has experienced a flashback and anyone who may have been drugged and violated in any way. I shared my story because I, much like Giselle Pellico, believe that we must bring these sexual crimes to the forefront of conversation topics. Okay, wow, that's a lot. So let's end on a light note. I discuss in my book how I use silly jokes and music as coping methods. I'd like to end my podcast with a song that speaks to me and a little humor. The song for this podcast is Jason Mraz, and the name of the song is Living in the Moment. The lyric, "So I Just Let Go of What I Know I Don't Know," oh man, do they resonate with my thinking. So if you're struggling with letting go of something and just trying to live in the moment, give a listen to this song. It states what we all need to hear sometimes, and it just might help you. Also, it's a pretty good uplifting beat, and I'll be jogging to it later. It's kind of a great mantra, so I love it. And whether you're ready for it or not, here's the joke for this podcast. Oh my gosh, I'm already laughing. It's silly. Why do ducks have tails? To hide their butt quacks. I'm going to give another one. I wasn't a fan of facial hair, but eventually it grew on me. That one is so silly, and I'm a woman, but that one's kind of for John. So join me next week when I will be discussing healing methods that I've used over the years, and more recently, meaning the last 3 or so years. They include acupuncture, which I've already mentioned, and a psilocybin mushroom session that was pretty great. And joining me will be my acupuncturist, Donald Charlson from Scarborough, Maine. Thanks for listening to Flying Over the Hedge with your host, that's me, J. Lauren Sangster, author of the newly released book titled The Girl Who Flew Over the Honeysuckle Hedge, Her Lifelong Journey of Coping and Healing with CPTSD. Remember, I am not a mental health professional, but I am someone who has experienced a significant amount of trauma, who is discussing my experiences, the effects of those experiences, coping methods, and healing. If you or someone you know has experienced trauma and you are having difficulty coping, I encourage you to seek help with a mental health professional. My call to action is practice self-compassion. What does that mean? It means responding to yourself with understanding and kindness, especially when you make a mistake, and we all make mistakes. Again, for more information, including a page of websites I mentioned during my podcast, please visit flyingoverthehedge.com. Remember to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or wherever you like to listen to podcasts. Thank you.
Produced by Audavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.